Well, if you've watched or read any superhero stories before, you'll know that they all carry something in common. Superman, Spider-Man, Batman, Captain America, Wonder Woman, you name it. They all share this subplot. Everyone is trying to figure out who is behind the mask. Amidst all of the battling crime, evil foes, and romances with unsuspecting ladies, except of course in the case of Wonder Woman, the stories all contain the identity crisis theme. And perhaps the most known cry comes from the Lone Ranger series, and granted not exactly a superhero along the lines of Spider-Man and other tight-wearing superheroes. After every one of his valiant rescues, the crowds are left asking the famous line, "Who was that masked man?" Identity crisis. This is actually what John 7 is about. By this point, Jesus is well into his ministry. In fact, with this story, Jesus has officially concluded his time in the Galilee. From here on out, the whole story shifts to be around Jerusalem, except to the very end where Jesus returns again with his disciples to Galilee. And still, while Jesus has now been active for at least 2 years, and while the whole region has had at least heard of his name, people, as we'll see, are still very much confused. They knew he was Jesus, but they didn't really know who he was. And more specifically, they didn't know if he was the Christ, the Messiah, the one that they had been told by their prophets of old to expect, the King who was coming into the world to set them free. And so as I say, this then is what John 7 will now be about. Who is Jesus of Nazareth? The chapter is actually the beginning of one long story that takes place right through to the end of John chapter 9. The story takes place at Jerusalem during the festival of booths, or tabernacles, or as the Hebrews would call the festival, Sukkot. In chapters 7 and 8, as we're going to see, Jesus is going to use this festival as a springboard to say two very important things about himself. For those with ears to hear, he's going to answer their identity question. And then, in chapter 9, the story is going to conclude with Jesus performing another one of his signs. He's going to let a blind man see by washing his eyes in a special pool of water. But as we'll see when we get to chapter 9 in the later teaching, the miracle isn't just a miracle, as I say, it's a sign. Jesus is helping the blind man to see, yes, but he's doing so that he can see something deeper about him. And it just so happens that it's all connected to what Jesus says about himself at the Festival of Booths in chapter 7 and 8. We'll see what Jesus says combined with the festival and the underlying meaning of the festival itself. They all come together in the sign to say something about him. It's really quite amazing. And as we saw in a couple of teachings ago, we remember again, John's gospel is all so layered. And this means a couple of things. First of all, it means that if we're going to get the full weight of Jesus' words and actions in these chapters, then we're going to need to know something about the Festival of the Tabernacles. And so in the next teacher, I'm going to go into great length about explaining what the Tabernacles was all about. The second thing it means is that you need to pay close attention to chapter 7 and chapter 8 in order for an interpretation of chapter 9 to happen effectively. Again, what we understand is that context in John's gospel helps bring the story so much off the page. I'll help walk us through in the podcast to come. But for this podcast and the next, we're going to begin just with John chapter 7. Everyone wants to know who Jesus is, and he's going to use the festival to help them understand a little bit more about himself. The chapter is actually divided into three neat sections, and John gives us verbal clues to help us make sense of the sections and to understand that they're unique and that they stand on their own. In verses 1 to 13, we read that it takes place at the beginning of the feast, and Jesus makes his way towards Jerusalem for the beginning of the feast. Then in verses 14 to 37, we read that it takes place partway through the feast, and so naturally it forms then the middle section of the story. And finally, verses 38 to 52 takes place on the last and the greatest day of the feast, and that is where Jesus is going to finally step up to the microphone in a very clear way and speak about who he is. And so we're going to take each of these sections in turn. In this teaching, we're going to deal with the first two sections. In the next teaching, we'll deal just with the last and greatest day of the feast, the last section of it. Okay, so to begin, let's begin reading verses 1 to 13. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee, purposely staying away from Judea because the Jews there were wanting to take his life. But when the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, "You ought to leave here and go to Judea so that your disciples may see the miracles you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you're doing these things, show yourself to the world." For even his own brothers did not believe in him. Therefore, Jesus told them, "The right time for me has not yet come. For you, any time is right. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that what it does is evil. You go to the feast. I'm not yet going up to the feast, because for me the right time has not yet come." Having said this, he stayed in the Galilee. However, after his brothers had left for the feast, he went also, not publicly, but in secret. Now at the feast, the Jews were watching for him and asking, "Where is that man?" Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some said, "He's a good man." Others replied, "No, he deceives the people." But no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the Jews. In this case, probably the Jews being the leaders of the Jewish people. So it should be clear to us what's happening here, especially after the introduction. The stage is being set. It's the beginning of the fest, and Jesus is in Galilee. His brothers begin to taunt him about going to Jerusalem so that he can show himself to the world, as they say. See, they understood well that the Christ, the Messiah, was going to be a public figure. The prophets described him as a great leader, a king, and a warrior. And so the brothers urged Jesus that he needs to go up to Jerusalem if he is going to be this, the place where all kings would obviously act from. They had ever since the time of David. But then, in verse 5, John lets us in on a little secret. A secret that Jesus' response makes clear that he knew. The brothers of Jesus, at this point, even his brothers, did not believe that he was the one. They obviously knew that he was a miracle worker. They comment about his miracles. But they were not sure that he was the Messiah. And so it seems that their urging for him to come out of the shadows of Galilee was their own way of testing. They wanted to know for themselves, who was their brother? Who really was he? They were trying to flush him out. Well, next the scene swings then to Jerusalem. And we learn there that the buzz around Jesus had obviously reached a critical level because the crowds there were wondering about his whereabouts. But what we see in their conversation was that the crowds were still very much uncertain about him. Some felt he was a good man, it said, but others said, no, he's trying to deceive the people. All this identity crisis stuff. And at the risk of overstating things from past teachings, we need to remember that for the Jews in the time of Jesus, their great desire was to finally see their Messiah. They wanted the leader to rise up and to overthrow Rome, their evil oppressor. The people, having heard about Jesus then, were clearly wondering, is he the one? But at this point, no one was sure, not even his brothers. As I say, Jesus has been caught up in an identity crisis. Okay, let's read on. Verse 14. Not until halfway through the feast did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. The Jews were amazed and asked, "How did this man get such learning without having studied?" Jesus answered, "My teaching is not my own. It comes from him who sent me. If anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. He who speaks on his own does not do so to gain honor for himself. But he who works for the honor of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There's nothing false about him. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet not one of you keeps the law. Why are you trying to kill me?" "You're demon-possessed," the crowd answered. "Who's trying to kill you?" Jesus said to them, "I did one miracle, and you are all astonished. Yet because Moses gave you circumcision, though actually did not come from Moses, but from the patriarchs, you circumcise a child on the Sabbath. Now if a child can be circumcised on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, why are you angry with me for healing the whole man on the Sabbath?" The story that we read in John chapter 5. "Stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment." Okay, so halfway through the feast, we see that Jesus then makes his way to Jerusalem, and he begins to teach then in the temple courts. And soon a crowd gathers around him, and immediately they begin to ask him questions. Actually, if you'll see as we go on, they ask him three questions, and each of the questions are about people trying to resolve and to get to the bottom of who Jesus is. They're all identity questions. And as we'll see, Jesus is going to answer essentially each of the questions with the same root answer. Question number one we see comes in verse 15. As the crowds are gathered around, amazed by his teaching, they ask, "How did this man get so smart?" Or in other words, "Who taught you all of this stuff?" And Jesus' reply to them is, "God. God sent me and God taught me." And as he then goes on to say, Jesus wants nothing more than to honor and obey him as his true rabbi, as his true teacher. And so therefore he speaks and he teaches only what his rabbi would have him say. And he works only then for his rabbi's honor. That seems fair, even quite noble. The kind of thing that every religious leader would piously say, "I have been taught by God." But if you've been following through these teachings for a while now, one thing you'll have seen is that when it comes to the religious in Israel, Jesus often has a hard time just leaving things at this nice, palatable, acceptable, comfortable level, which is what we see then in verse 19. And here he pushes things further with the crowd. "You claim to have Moses as your teacher, but I know that not one of you follows the law." The implication is clear. Not only are they not following Moses, but actually they're not following God, the true rabbi that Jesus follows and teaches and is their teacher, because they're not keeping the law. Which would have been news to them, because they all felt that they were doing so scrupulously. You can almost hear the indignation that rumbles back from the crowd. "Not keeping the law? What on earth could we ever do that is not in keeping with the law?" You can see the Pharisees just kind of getting their backs up against the assertion. And so Jesus gives them the answer at the end of verse 19. Well, let's see. Number one on the list of commandments, no gods before me. No? Okay. You think you're doing okay with that. All right. Number three, keeping the Sabbath. Well, we've been through that one already, and clearly we have a difference of opinion on what it means to keep the Sabbath. Number nine, false testimony. No, that one is yet to come. It's coming, though. Wait a second. I've got it. Number six, you shall not murder. Of course. Did that one slip my mind? Now I know that you haven't actually killed me yet, but you're planning on it. Why are you trying to kill me? Of course, in verse 20, the crowds explode. "You're demon-possessed! What are you talking about?" And so for the rest of the section, then, Jesus goes on to explain that they are wanting to kill him because of his actions on number three law, that is, keeping the Sabbath. They didn't like him healing someone on the Sabbath in John chapter 5, and so they wanted him dead. But it was all so perplexing to Jesus. Because as he would say, on the one hand, they found it okay to circumcise a child on the Sabbath to keep their law, but it was not okay somehow in somebody's strange mind to heal the whole man. And clearly the undercurrent of the whole exchange was that while they didn't get the law or the Sabbath law, and while they were using it for their own religious purposes, Jesus did get it. He understood it. And he got it because he is the one that had been taught by God. And now all he wanted to do was honor God, even or perhaps especially if that meant healing on a holy day. Who is Jesus? Answer one, he is the one that has been taught by his rabbi, who is God, and he is the one that is seeking to honor him by doing his will. And I suppose the undercurrent or the assumption of this is to this crowd of people then, he was giving them also an invitation. To a crowd of people that were failing so miserably in interpreting and understanding the law, Jesus was now saying, "Come, I will show you what it means to fulfill my Father's law. I will show you what it means to live in alignment with God." The question is, would anybody acknowledge that Jesus really was being taught by God? And in that then, would they fall in alignment with his way of living righteously before God? It's not just a great question for the Jews of that day. It's a great question for us as well. Will we follow in in alignment with Jesus and how he shows us what it means to be faithful to God? Or will we continue to look for our own ways of what it actually means to be righteous? The church is notorious for this. We set up all sorts of structures and things that we think, this then is what it really means to be righteous. And oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, Jesus is over in the other side saying, guys, look at me. Set aside all your petty little things and look at me. I will show you what it means to live in alignment with God. Will we see him and will we follow? That's the question. It was the questions before the Jews in that day, and it's the question before us today. Okay, let's keep reading. Verse 25. At that point, some of the people of Jerusalem began to ask, isn't this the man they're trying to kill? Here he is speaking publicly, and they're not saying a word to him. Have the authorities really concluded that he is the Christ? But we know where this man is from. When the Christ comes, no one will know where he is from. Then Jesus, still teaching in the temple courts, cried out, yes, you know me, and you know where I'm from. I'm not here on my own, but he who sent me is true. You do not know him, because I know him, because I am from him, and he sent me. At this they tried to seize him, but no one laid a hand on him, because his time had not yet come. Still, many in the crowds put their faith in him. They said, when the Christ comes, will he do more miraculous signs than this man? Well, after Jesus' first answer, the crowds now then are swirled into even more confusion. And as they are, we see more clearly the real heart now of their concern. They want to know if he is the Christ, or more precisely, they wanted to know if their leaders had concluded that he was the Christ. They were looking to the leaders to help them understand who Jesus was. Unfortunately, as Jesus will go on to say more and more as the gospel goes along, their leaders were so misguided. And this questioning then leads to the next major question in verse 27. We know where the Messiah has come from. So where is Jesus from? And Jesus responds to the question by saying, God. The same answer as before. He's come from God. They're all looking for a human answer for where the Christ was going to come from, but all along they were missing the main thing. The Christ was coming first from God himself. And Jesus' answer couldn't be more clear on this matter, clearly articulating that he was from God, and while they don't know him, another jab, he does. And with this, some in the crowds put their faith in him. Could the Christ do any more miraculous signs than him? While others wanted to seize him. It's the same response every time. Who is Jesus? He is the one who has come from God, just as the prophets said the Messiah would. Okay, let's read the last section here, verse 32. The Pharisees heard the crowd whispering such things about him. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees sent temple guards to arrest him. Jesus said, I'm with you for only a short time, and then I go to the one who sent me. You will look for me, but you will not find me, and where I am you cannot come. The Jews said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we cannot find him? Will he go where our people have scattered among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? What did he mean when he said, you will look for me, but you will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? And finally, we come to the last question. As the temple guards prepare to arrest him, again, failing in their own plan to murder, Jesus looks at the onlookers and says to them a rather curious comment. He tells them that he's only going to be with them now for a short time, and that he's soon going to go where they cannot come. Of course, it's a leading statement that naturally gets them asking another question. Well, where are you going? Are you going to our people among the Greeks to help them understand things as well? And as Jesus answers them, he gives them another point of self-disclosure. Where is he going? God. He's been taught by God. He comes from God, and now he says that he's returning to God. And the great irony here is that he's telling this to a crowd that really felt they had the Messiah thing worked out. They were the children of God, and they had the line exactly on how God was going to work, but they had muddled the whole thing up. And perhaps on this last point, they had missed it more than at any other point. As I've said many times in these teachings, everyone was expecting the Messiah to come as this great military leader. He was going to overthrow Israel's enemies and return the exiles of Israel to the land. From there, he was going to establish Israel as the world's great kingdom, with him serving as the king, and he was going to rebuild their temple to make the way for the glory of God to again reign with his people forever. And this thing is, Jesus intended and would do all of these things. The prophet said that he would. He was going to do all these things, just not the way anyone was expecting, and nor within the time frame that anyone was expecting. Would he overthrow the enemy of God's people? Yes, but the enemy was not first and foremost of this world. Would he build a kingdom? Yes, but it would start out small, imperceptibly, invisibly. Would he gather the exiles? Yes, but he would gather the exiles of other nations as well. Everyone who had been exiled from God, like prodigal children who were lost in other lands, everyone was going to be called home to God. And what about the temple? Well, he was going to rebuild it too, but its walls would be made of living stones of people, filled up with the Spirit of God. He did everything the prophet said that Messiah was going to do, but few, as he often said, had eyes to see or ears to hear. It's why now they are so confused about his identity. Is he really the Messiah? Then why is he acting this way? Why isn't he acting the way that we expect him to do? And to add to all of the confusion is Jesus' comment here. He says to them, "And I'm returning to God." And they're all scratching their heads saying, "What? That's just wasn't part of the Messiah role as they understood it." Nobody was expecting the Messiah after he came to return to God. And least of all, they weren't expecting him to die and be resurrected and then return as they were about to soon see and as Jesus was talking about to them. They had their own understandings and convictions. And it was because of this, as I say, that they had become so confused now about his identity. And so in instances like these, what we see then Jesus doing is he's trying to help people to lay down their own expectations and come to understand what the Messiah was actually about. And in so doing, perhaps they might see that he really was the one they were looking for. Guys, you're wondering who I am. And you're wondering because I'm not lining up with your expectations. It's time to lay down your expectations and embrace what I'm saying and I'm doing. I am the one that has been taught by God. I am the one that comes from God. And I am the one that is returning to God. I'm the one. Stop looking for someone else. Stop looking for someone to fulfill your own agenda and see and hear what it is that I'm saying to you. And while you might think that that's enough by way of self-disclosure, Jesus wasn't finished yet. He had another thing to say, and it would take place on the last and the greatest day of the feast. And we'll come to that in the next teaching. For now, meditate on these wonderful realities. Jesus is the one that has been taught by God, and we can see and understand what it means to follow God by seeing him. He is the one who is from God. We don't need to look anywhere else. And he is the one who has returned to God. And as he says, he will return to us again someday. There is no one who is like him.